And coming up your way, it's the Bathrob Spears Broadsides July 6th, 2023 show, the Thursday show. And this is another flashback show. Those Huff meetings are taking it out of me these days, I'm afraid. And sometimes we may even include some of what the Huff, in fact, maybe in this particular edition, folks are saying. In any case, you'll be hearing an interview with Keith McHenry, who seems to be doing better, which is good news. You'll be hearing from Monica, and also likely from Whip 'em into Shape Wes over in Salinas. And who knows, I may be able to tag a few other folks in, but it'll otherwise be a flashback, which I'll be announcing once I reach it. And you'll hear about that at that time.
I'm tired of moon songs, of star and of June songs. They simply make me nap. And ditties romantic drive me nearly frantic. I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't love you.
So let's jump right in with the Katzenjammer Keith McHenry. I guess I'm the only one who calls him that, but he's always expressed me as a very jovial guy, a prankster in a way, and yet a person who is also quite serious about what he does. He's been ill with spinal problems, prompted originally by a police assault back in 1992, according to his account. He's been sort of laid up at home for a couple of months now, if not maybe 3 months, I don't know, and actually warily eyeing surgery, but it looks like he may not have to. But in any case, you get to hear him talk about it, so let's listen. Okay, we're going to try this again. This is an interview with Keith McHenry on July 2nd, about 10:30 in the morning, by phone. Hey, Keith.
So, how's that sound?
Sounds good. Sounds good, actually.
Beautiful. See, I told you.
Yeah, no, you were right. Well, you sounded good initially, so, you know, let's see if it keeps up.
Yeah, hopefully it'll stay happening.
Well, there are a couple things I wanted to ask you about. One is your health, which, according to our conversation yesterday, is on the upswing. Is that correct?
Yeah, I'm starting to feel like I might be solving this problem, so excited about that. That is good.
Problem is a spinal problem?
Yeah. It's been a drag, and it's been since February 16th. Here, 1 second, I got it. Yeah, so that's been a real bummer. And I'm hoping, I've been doing chiropractic and losing weight.
So you've decided against having surgery?
Yeah, I'm still worried about having surgery. Don't really want it.
Right. So it's not an alternative you've closed off, but not one.
But I haven't closed it off. Yeah, I still got like an appointment for that, just in case.
Gotcha.
It's a bummer. But
are you getting out more now? Heading for, social engagements, political activity?
Yeah, I do. And then typically around in the afternoon, my back is super sore, and then I come back and lay around. So that's kind of what I've been doing, and a lot of I've been writing an essay, so which is a good sign because I haven't written since February 16th, and so now I'm like working on an essay about the, the United States looks to be pretty clearly one of their strategies is to cause a radiation leak at the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power station in Ukraine to bring the U.S. more directly, or NATO itself, more directly into the conflict with Russia, because they're, you know, the Ukrainians are losing.
And what evidence do you
thousands
have?
Thousands of more people a day, maybe more. So.
What evidence do you have of this?
Oh, there's a ton of evidence. So the main evidence is that Zelensky keeps repeatedly saying that Russia is going to sabotage the nuclear power station. And he posted like three or four tweets this morning saying that, including one where he's got a picture of the nuke behind him and on a green screen. And then all the defense ministers and everybody else in Ukraine is saying that this is definitely going to happen. And then they're doing radiation decontamination exercises in Ukraine. They're giving out iodine pills to everybody in Ukraine. They've got like a they're removing people from the area of the nuclear power station. Both the Russians and the U.S. are doing that, or what we, you know, colloquially call the Ukrainians. And so all that's going on, and the Atomic Energy Commission is saying that they have no evidence of the Russians doing anything.
So, has Zelensky presented any evidence, or have any of these?
He says that intelligence, Ukrainian intelligence says that this is definitely happening.
But he hasn't presented the reports specifically, right?
There are no reports. It's just like there was no reports about when the U.S. did in the Nord Stream pipeline, nor when the U.S. Blew up the dam, or when the U.S. did any of the other atrocities through this war. There's never any. You know, like, so with the Nord Stream 2 bombing, which is complete, you know, which Seymour Hersh ties directly to Biden and the core leadership in the White House, and off-the-books Army SEAL, Navy SEAL unit out of Pensacola, and, you know, there's like a ton of evidence showing that the United States...
Well, is there any evidence similar to that of Seymour Hersh tying Zelensky's propaganda statements to...
Well, the thing that we know is that there's no evidence that Russia, according to the National Atomic Energy Commission, is doing what Zelensky keeps, like, for a week now, saying that is happening.
Is there any evidence that anybody is doing it? Russia?
Huh? Atomic Energy Commission says that their inspectors on the scene at the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power station do not see any evidence of what Zelensky is saying.
Right. Well, so does this mean that Zelensky is just cooking up a tale? But you're extending this to say that you feel this indicates that the U.S. is now planning to to do some manufactured nuclear accident there.
They're doing a bunch of different things. The other thing is that the U.S. Senate has just Richard Blumenthal from Connecticut, a Democrat, Lindsey Graham from Republican just introduced during the last week a resolution that the U.S. would go to war with Russia if there is a radiation event in Ukraine. So that's now up for a vote in the U.S.
And of course, that is not evidence that it is actually likely to happen from whatever source. It is simply, pumping up the fuel to be afraid of Russia, pumping up the need for more weapons, for more alliances, and so forth.
We hope that there's so many analysts that are sharing my specific point of view that are following this as closely or even more closely than me, that agree that this is just like, we hope that they don't do this. But
name two of them, Keith.
They're going to do this.
Name two of those analysts.
Max Blumenthal has been writing on it. There's, Colonel McGregor, the weapons inspector person, Scott.
Scott Ritter?
No, was the one that centered in the weapons of mass destruction. And
Scott Ritter, you know.
Yeah, so all these people, basically there's a huge host of people. I mean, but it's also kind of obvious by events. Why would you be, so Ukraine is losing the war brutally. They're trying to get into NATO. There's a NATO summit in Estonia next week where Zelensky's like, well, I'm not going there unless you let us into NATO. Russia's red line is Ukraine never becomes part of NATO. And the U.S. also has a track record already of doing in the Nord Stream 2 and a dam. So, and they've been, you know, and the statements of the U.S. State Department around this indicate that this is very likely. What the generals are saying, very likely. You know, everybody's in on it, really ready to go down for the World War III. And you don't, you know, you could also look at, you know, Biden was like, oh, if we give Ukraine, you know, tanks, you know, it'll be, you know, that'll lead to World War III. And now they've done tanks.
You see any evidence of anti-war activity on the West Coast around this issue?
Nobody seems to give a flying crap. Now, here's the other thing I want to say in this essay, which is why I think of people writing essays, I should write an essay, is that I grew up with my grandfather, who was an OSS, Office of Strategic Services, and he led, out of Burma, Operation Meeting House, which is, even to this day, according to Daniel Ellsberg, I was listening to him up at the university a few years ago, is the most deadly bombing campaign in world history, and Wikipedia still claims that is true. So he directed that. He said he killed 5 million people. The Wikipedia had it at 1 million for a while. Now I think it's down to 500,000. I watched him for several years during the Vietnam. Well, then OSS, just so people know, that became CIA, or it was replaced by the CIA at the end of World War II. And he was super tight with Curtis LeMay. That was one of his best friends. And Westmoreland, who was Secretary of War, Defense at the time. And I used to watch him argue with both of them to demand that we launch a nuclear missile, or drop a nuclear missile at that time, on Hanoi to communicate to the Soviet Union and China that we would stop at nothing to defend corporate power. And I watched him year after year, and he was training me to become one of these people in the future. He was like telling me all about why we set up phony elections, because we got to keep people divided. That's why we have the elections. That we would never allow anybody other than us, the genetically superior, according to him, make any decisions that fundamentally change the direction of the United States. That is just theater, and it's to keep people, it's the bread and circuses, and we will never, under any circumstances, allow there to be democracy in the United States. That would be forbidden, it would be suicidal, it would be the height of craziness, basically.
What do you make, Keith, of the Cornell West People's Party, Green Party thing?
I like Cornell West. And it'd be great if he, like, screws up the Democratic Party and all that by running. And it looks like RFK is already screwing up the Democratic Party, which are a mafia organization. So I don't think all that stuff is insanity, basically. I just watched an interview of Colonel McGregor, who is oddly one of the only voices in the Trump administration, in the military portion of it, who urged Trump not to launch all that war on Iran, while the rest of the generals wanted him to start a war with Iran. Anyway, he's concerned that there might not be an election. And a number of people are putting that out. So many crazy things are going on that it would not be implausible that there's a national security issue, and it could be accidentally created. But I have to say, no one, you know, who the CIA chooses to be the president of the United States next, that I don't have any idea who they're going to choose. Some speculate that it would be Newsom, actually. But the people, Victoria Nuland, who I've been following, she's like the deputy undersecretary for the State Department under Anthony Blinken. Both of them involved in the coup and so on. And in a bunch of nefarious things around the Clinton administration and the Biden administration. Anyway, there's the Fuck the EU audio tape, who people presume was like either Estonia had taped the conversation or Russia had, but not clear who taped the conversation between U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, Pratt, and to Victoria Nuland before the U.S. coup, where they decide who's going to be the president after they overthrow the government of Ukraine, and who then would be in the cabinet. And they select all the members in this phone conversation. And then she signs off saying that Vice President Biden gave them all the attaboy for the coup. And that's in the...
I've heard the, you know, it's been...
Yeah, so anyway...
Let me shift...
Crazy things since back then.
Let me shift a bit to stuff closer to home. Yesterday, I believe you told me you were going to go visit Baba Ito. Who is Baba Ito, and did you visit him?
Yeah, so Baba Ito is a kind of a colorful character in Santa Cruz who has done healings of people on Pacific Garden Mall and so on over the decades, and and you probably have been handed a photocopy yourself of an article in the City on the Hill college paper about him healing people on Pacific Garden Mall like 20 years ago or something like that.
So it's time for a musical break here, and we'll break with a song called Guanajuato, which is a city in Mexico. It's also the name of a song by David Rovix, which he describes this way. Volunteers with a group called No More Deaths were arrested on July 9th, 2005, and threatened with long prison sentences. Their crime? Taking a man who appeared to be dying in the Arizona desert to the hospital rather than to the Border Patrol.
I was raised in Guanajuato, that's where I was born. For 1,000 years, that's where my family grew the corn. Farming's what we lived by, and farming's what we knew. And then the gobierno signed NAFTA, and our farming days were through. I had to leave the village, there was no other way. I had to find work somewhere or starve if I should stay. In Ciudad de Mexico, I tried to survive, but the colonias were full, there was no work to stay alive. I went Tijuana, the maquila factories, people living by the sewage, dying on their knees. It was then in desperation I knew I had to go, leave the country I was born in, the only one I know. Across the unknown deserts to the other side, around the wall that stretches on 100 miles wide. I trudged on for days, I don't know how far I got, but I never knew in all my life the sun could be so hot. My feet had turned to blisters, my water bag run dry. I thought about mi madrecita as I looked up at the sky. I lay down for the last time, parched upon the ground. Maybe someday my body will be found, eaten by the vultures, bones bleached in the sun. Maybe I'll go to heaven, if there is one. And I guess someone in California who wants to make their fields green, gonna have to find another Mexican to keep their dishes clean.
Yesterday, I believe you told me you were going to go visit Baba Ito. Who is Baba Ito, and did you visit
him? So Baba Ito is a kind of a colorful character in Santa Cruz who has done healings of people on Pacific Garden Mall and so on over the decades, and he and you probably have been handed a photocopy yourself of an article in the City on the Hill college paper about him healing people at Pacific Garden Mall like 20 years ago or something like that. And anyway, he was always kind of floating through Food Not Bombs for years, and he's always trying to keep his appearance up and everything, and he thinks because of this healing power that he has, which I've experienced, which he definitely has, that it might indicate that he's a Messiah, right, of the Jewish Messiah. And he made all kinds of drunk, had all this jewelry that he made of stones. He was, like, really into, like, quartz and all that kind of stuff, and did raps, and his biggest, I think the biggest mental health barrier that he technically would have is he loved talking, which would slow him down, because he would meet you on a street corner and meet somebody on the street corner. He had 3 hours talking to him instead of doing something that would have, like, fix his van or whatever it was that he needed to happen. And he was just a funny guy, and I remember he would tell me that he was from Carmel, you know, and he was married to a wealthy socialite in Carmel at one point, and so on. Anyway, so that's his kind of background, and he definitely was a really kind person, very smart, very offbeat, and definitely not a danger to anyone, not a danger to himself, other than that he takes up a lot of time by talking to people, and which might be his biggest, like I said, his biggest mental health issue, is he just delayed himself in life by never not stopping talking. And so anyway, he had a Cherokee van car, you know, van type thing, and a van that he lived in. And then when COVID happened, he ended up, after half a year living in the van during COVID, into the Oceana. So right now he's 78 years old. So he he was at the Oceana, and there was a new tenant in the room next to him, and there was some music going on, and this is according to Bobby Ito, and it's probably pretty well, you know, makes some sense. So there was a record that stuck in from the new tenant in the room next to him, and it was like 3 a.m, and the same song was repeating and repeating, and he kept go to the room and knock on the door to see if they're okay, if they could turn the music off. You know, it was like loud in his room, and then the management failed to come up and find out whether the person in the room was live or dead or what was going on or even in the room. And so then he got frustrated because the management wouldn't come up there, so he called the police. The police came and took him away in an ambulance and put him in the psych ward at Dominican Hospital. So then he, while he's there, he's unable to pay his bills or make any phone calls, so he starts losing his belongings.
When was this, well, Keith? When was this?
And this would be right before they closed the Oceana, like a week before they closed the Oceana. So that's like a year ago, maybe. It's when the Benchland still was happening, and a week after he was removed from the Oceana, everybody was removed from the Oceana, and handed a pup tent, a yoga mat, and a sleeping bag, and sent to the Benchlands, and particularly, and that's somebody else I got to deal with today, is Nikki, who just got kicked out of the armory. So anyway, she was sent to the Benchlands with the other, about like 30 other seniors, and by the county. And the county came actually 3 days before the announced eviction. So, and my sense of that was that way we wouldn't be there when they were kicking everybody out. They pulled us, you know, I was personally prepared to arrive on the day they announced they were kicked out, and then the next day, I hear the door kicked out before that date. So, anyway, so Bobby Ito ends up there, and then he ends up over at Telecare. He still can't make any phone calls out. So approximately 2.5 months of being unable to communicate to the outside world, he loses almost everything. He loses, like,
now he was, vehicles. Keith, let me interrupt you. He was held in Telecare, which is a Santa Cruz-based organization?
Yeah, Telecare would be the private mental health facility on Soquel, correct.
And he was there for 2.5 months, because I had heard that they... did he say whether he was forcibly medicated, by the way?
Yeah, he was forcibly medicated, correct.
Because the claims of some people in our group who claimed to have knowledge of Telecare, the Huff group, is that they don't do that, but they send people off to other places to be forcibly medicated, like Santa Clara.
Oh, he was forcibly medicated at Dominican Hospital, not at Telecare.
Now, you know this because he told you this, or because...
Yeah, and the paperwork that I saw. Yeah, I photographed a lot of his paperwork from his... So we do know that he got, he got a booster shot, and then he was sent to... And then when he was at Dominican, they diagnosed him as having myocarditis, according to the paperwork I had.
Now, was he given a psychiatric diagnosis as well?
And he has a psychiatric diagnosis, which is bipolar.
Was he forcibly medicated for that?
He thinks he is. This is unclear. But there is, like, he's been told he's been getting a psych med. He's been trying not to get a psych med. Yesterday he was... back further than that. So when I saw him in the week before he was captured by the police at Oceana, he was a completely healthy-looking, normal weight human being, completely lucid, as I had known him for years. I'd known him since at least 2013. So he was completely in good health. For his age, he was actually in really good health. And he had no complaints about any kind of even aches and pains. It was like it's incredible. He was doing really well. So then, after he goes through this whole thing at Dominican Mental Hospital and at Telecare, he gets sent to El Dorado, which is like a kind of a outpatient mental health facility over in Live Oak. And that's when he calls me, so I go over to visit him. And he's already starting to look pretty thin.
When did he call you?
That would have been, like six, after he'd been captured for maybe 2 months, 2.5 months, something like that. So I go visit him there, and he's really depressed at that point. He's like, he's got like he gives me the business card. I take a picture of the business card of his conservator. So he's end up with a conservator named Barbara. And so I call her, and I say, "Look, I know Bobby Eno for all these years. He's very wacky. He's not sure if he's a Messiah, but he thinks he might be. And I know a lot of people think that's very unusual for people to believe that they're the Messiah, but he's completely harmless to both himself and anybody else. He's just a character, and he's a lively, beautiful character that should not be, forced into anything, and she goes, "Well, I've never talked to him before. I don't know. I got a case. He's, I'm the conservator, but, thanks for calling." And,
how long has he been conserved?
It's got to be almost 2 years now, a year and a half, something like that.
How did it happen?
Then after he got out of El Dorado, they put him in a place over across from the Simpkin Swim Center, off of 17th, with three other really out there people that were not almost nonverbal people in their middle-aged guys. But they never said a word to me. And one guy just sat there and watched football every time I went to visit. So I started bringing him organic vegetables. Because whoever this person's helping him just gave him crap food, and he was, like, bumming. So when I'm there, he's now, like, lost probably a third of his weight.
How heavy is he now?
He's 105 pounds.
And when did you see him? You talking about yesterday?
75 pounds when he got captured by the government. He's 105 pounds right now.
And you... So that was yesterday when you saw him.
Yeah, and so when I saw him yesterday, he actually has virtually no muscle anywhere on his body. He looks exactly like his butt and his legs and his chest and everything, exactly like the photos of the people that when they got liberated from Auschwitz or Dachau, exactly. He couldn't look more exactly like that. He's not on IV in the hospital. He's not. He thinks that they're putting this psych drug, which is written up on the board at his in his room. But he has he has a question for his doctor about the psych medicine because he doesn't want to take it, and but there's no answer to his question on the board. There's a question and answer. Answer is blank. From June 16th, there's a question. I want to talk to the doctor about this Epcora or whatever. I forget the name of it now, but like a psych drug. He said he doesn't want to take it, but he thinks it's being put in his food. And he believes he's going to be shipped off to someplace out of town so that people like me can't come and visit him. And he thinks he's going to die soon. I mean, he looks like he will die soon.
Has anybody else been visiting him?
Nobody's. I'm the only person to visit him. And it's, but it's tragic. He's like almost gone. He can't stand up. You know, he stood up for a second just to show me, like, his body. It's insanity. And then his room was all filthy. You know, he has to use, like, a plastic bottle. And you can see the pee is all on the floor underneath his table where his food is. He's a vegetarian. They gave him chicken yesterday. The toilet, which he can't, he doesn't, it's just was an unbelievable mess. It was so disgusting in there. And I went and told the nurse, like, you need to clean this room.
Keith, what's the name of this joint?
This is Dominican Hospital. And it's, and he's in, I forget the number now, like 2051 or something like that. Yeah, he's a Dominican.
Does he want people to visit him?
I don't know if he does. I mean, if you know him well, you could go there and visit him, yeah. But I don't know if he really... He basically is all... He shut off the blind. You know, he's got... He doesn't want any light from outside in. He's got, like, a curtain. He wants you to close the curtain when you leave so that... You know, he's it's terrible. He thinks he's... So, this is the... You know, besides Bobby Ito, should never have gone through any of this. The county specifically seems to have intentionally killed him. I mean, I think that they're trying to kill him. And so I kept going, I was like, well, being bipolar is not like, usually if you're bipolar, you don't lose so much body weight that you are a skeleton. And they said, well, I also have diabetes, they said now. And so, of course, they gave him a big pile of rice with his chicken and everything. But all this stuff that you, if you're diabetic, is not really the best thing. I said, are you getting insulin? He said, no, I'm not getting insulin. And they say I'm diabetic. And then he had on his trunk that he refused another blood prick to see if he was diabetic. He just said, no. And, but anyway, he... So, like, if you lose that much weight, then, he's lost, like, you know, even when he was at El Dorado, he wasn't that thin, he became really thin when he ended up on 17th, and then when he ended up, now he's like, so he's got, you know, like, you must have cancer or some kind of thing, like, what is going on that you would lose all your body weight? It can't be, you know, being, bipolar is one of the symptoms of bipolar disorder is not starving to death and dying, you know. So,
but I'm going to interrupt again with a little bit of music. This one is called "Letter to My Landlord," another one by Rovix. He writes, "In July 2008, my landlord raised the rent on the apartment I had lived in for just over a year. He has since raised the rent every year. Now it is more than twice when it was when I moved in. For most other people in Portland, Oregon, things were worse. We need rent control now. Or ideally, we need to seize all properties owned by landlords who are not living in them after we nationalize all the banks that we bailed out. If we really were serious about dealing with the housing crisis, we'd house people, not just talk about it, while using the crisis as an excuse to build more unaffordable housing. Calling the housing affordable does not make it affordable. It just allows the developers to take advantage of tax loopholes and subsidies that do not get passed on in any useful way to the renters or mortgage holders, sometimes misleadingly referred to as homeowners."
I'm writing you this letter cause among the choices it's probably better than listening to voices raging in my head saying point and shoot. Then after you're dead, your face meets my boot. I don't know your name. better that way, cause I can't play this game, who knows what I'll say. I feel like I'm burning, I've had it up to here. It's time that you were learning the meaning of fear. I live in these apartments, are your private property, among your residents. Most of us agree that you're a piece of shit. How does that make you feel? We don't like you one bit, and that's for real. We think you're a thief, that you don't care. Seems your one belief is whatever the market will bear. Whatever you can get away with, what you can make us pay. If we ever get justice, you should fear that day, landlord. Landlord. But it's not just you, it's all your kin. The things you do cause the state we're in. You bribed the politicians so they'd let you off lead. Now the legal situation's just the one you need. For you to make millions, for profits to be high. But even billions won't be with you when you die. I hope you find the death you seek, meet the devil that you serve. If you live another week, that's more life than you deserve. Landlord. Landlord. In the class war you're waging, there's no question who is winning. But if there's any justice, this is only the beginning. The next act in the play will be written by the tenants. And until your dying day, you'll be paying penance. Your assets will be seized, that's a fucking given. You profiteers of misery, start spending time in prison. Then you can get a job, figure out what you do best. You can keep the house you live in, but we're taking all the rest. Landlord. 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 Yo, landlord.
And while we're on the subject, here's another one that he sang. I actually thought I hadn't played that before, the one I just played for you, but I have, but still. Bear's playing again. This one is, he writes this, does Rovix. It's called Landlord. The tenant farmers of upstate New York chose the auspicious date of July 4th, 1839, to announce that they would be engaging in a mass rent strike until the feudal system that had then governed the region would be broken up so the farmers could own their own land, rather than perpetually renting it at usurious rates from a useless feudal lord, a situation no different at all than the sorts of arrangements that were driving so many poor people to flee Europe in search of somewhere they'd stand a better chance of surviving and maybe prospering. After 9 years of refusing to pay the rent, mobilizing en masse on horseback, armed and masked, every time any of the farmers in the region were threatened by the landlords and their police, the tenant farmers who fought what was known as the rent strike wars were victorious.
The patroons came from Holland to America, became landlords where none had been before. Soon one man owned 500,000 acres on both sides of the Hudson River shore. He invited families to move in and give him 30% of everything they grew every year. This is how they'd pay the rent. His name was Rensselaer. He became one of the richest men on earth. In today's terms, $90 billion is how much he'd be worth. All this for doing nothing, but saying all of this was his. I have the power of the state behind me, and I'm in the landlord biz. After 200 years of this, and one revolution won, another Rensselaer had another son. And this Rensselaer was greedier than his ancestors dead and past. It was the 1840s and things were changing fast. It was the straw that broke the back. The bottle was uncorked.
They started organizing meetings, the tenant farmers of New York. They found the strength of numbers. They found the power of suggestion. They found each other, asking the same question. Who gave you the right to be a landlord, to live a life of ease while others toil? Who gave you the right to be a rich man, while the rest of us pay you so we can work this soil? They vowed they would stop the rent collection. They vowed they'd bring this madness to an end. And when one blew the tin horn of distress, he soon found he had a thousand friends. With calico skirts, masks upon their faces, on horseback, armed with knives and guns. They chanted and they yelled and they kept their farms and they kept the sheriffs on the run. They asked, who gave you the right to be a landlord, to live a life of ease while others toil? Who gave you the right to be a rich man, while the rest of us pay you so we can work this soil? The governor's militias tried to stop them, but nothing could be done to break their will. And by 1848, the landlords buckled, sold their holdings to the farmers in the hills. Yes, they overthrew this feudal system, but it's replaced now by speculators and banks. And you can still hear the homeless families asking, of all the landed gentry in our ranks, who gave you the right to be a landlord, to live a life of ease while others toil? Who gave you the right to be a rich man, while the rest of us pay you so we can work this soil? Who gave you the right to be a landlord, to live a life of ease while others toil? Who gave you the right to be a rich man, while the rest of us pay you so we can work this soil? Who gave you the right?
Back to the story of Baba Ito from Keith McHenry.
But anyway, so if you lose that much weight, then he's lost, like, you know, even when he was at El Dorado, he wasn't that thin. But he became really thin when he ended up over on 17th, and then when he ended up now, he's like, so he's got, you know, like, you must have cancer or some kind of thing. Like, what is going on that you would lose all your body weight? It can't be, you know, being bipolar, is one of the symptoms of bipolar disorder is not starving to death and dying, you know. So it seems like there's got to be some other health issue, but there's, like, clearly, you know, and with, because he's under conservatorship, no one will tell you what his issue is. I've got to see new paperwork. I'm going to ask.
So he didn't tell you what the reason was for the conservatorship.
Oh, yeah, the reason for the conservatorship is he's supposed to be bipolar.
Well, why would that? I mean, is he a danger to himself, others, or gravely disabled, or are they using looser standards?
Much looser standards, because the day he was captured, he was completely no problem.
So they're probably using the... What, are you using the care courts, or are they using something else, do you know?
No, they didn't. This is all pre-care court. Yeah.
Laura's Law supposedly hasn't been accepted by Santa Cruz.
Yeah, the whole thing is crazy. It's like they just captured him and killed him. And for no logical reason. Because there's not, because if you know Baba Ito over the years.
A little bit.
He tells you all about how he might get some money if he could just fix his car and go over to Silicon Valley. And he tells you about the beautiful wife he had in Carmel. He talks about all of his raps. He talks about his drums. He talks about rich people that he's met and known over the years. And he offers to do Healing Touch. That's his entire trip. He lived in a van. He's always was trying to repair the van. That was it. And he said he might be the Messiah because he has this ability with his hands and he healed a headache of mine at El Dorado in like 20 minutes. And he did a healing touch yesterday on my back, which helped immensely. So he's got some kind of an interesting cosmic thing that goes on with healing touch, which is probably when you've done that for, you know, he's like 79 years old now. You know, but he, unlike most of the Messiah complex people that I know in the world, which when you see the hungry, you meet a lot of these people that live on the streets that really do think they're Jesus or something, he's the only one I've ever met who says he might be. Almost everybody else is definitive about their position of being the Messiah. You know, he's the first person I've ever met who said he might be. So it's a very interesting thing. So he's a very wacky guy.
Now, does he have phone access? Even
before, when he was totally healthy, he was too... Yeah, there's no evidence that he had a messy room at the Oceana because he was making all these wraps and stuff, and he was like, you know, and he's disorganized. But
does he have a phone number?
You shouldn't be killed for being disorganized. You know, and that's,
I'll agree with you there. Does he have a phone access?
Yeah, and he does. I can get you. I'll write down his phone number, and then I'll call you back with it.
Okay, sounds good. Does he want to be called?
Yeah, and somehow he survived. He's kept his cell phone going. I don't know how that. I guess that's where his SSI goes, is to pay for the cell phone.
Is his conservator willing to let him out if somebody takes him in or something or not?
I don't know. I'm going to call her, after the 4th of July weekend and see what can happen.
Right.
Because, when where he was horrible. And I don't know how he ended up in the hospital. I think he ended up in the hospital because he couldn't walk anymore. And so he finally called the ambulance and had him, and he couldn't deal with the psychos that were living with him. So they just took him to the hospital. But yeah, the mystery is, why did he lose so much weight? How can he become 100, lose 75 pounds? You know, it's insane.
Any new updates on Food Not Bombs locally or nationally?
We're just still doing our weekend thing, although we finally got the donated stove that we were waiting for, a commercial stove and oven, we're slowly building a new kitchen, so that's exciting. One of our dear, dear volunteers, Gray, passed away from cancer on June 5th. There was a big memorial service for him yesterday over at this Mid-County Senior Center. And it was interesting to meet his family and people that in the Early Risers Fellowship that he was involved in, the AA thing that he helped organize. So besides doing Food Not Bombs all the time, and he lived in his van or in Rio Del Mar. He lived at the beach in his van for years. And he set up a whole Alcoholics Anonymous website for the county and all these things like that. Then he turned out he started running Zoom meetings for AA Zoom meetings and even had participants from as far away as Australia in his Zoom meetings, AA Zoom meetings that he set up. So he was very, very well loved. He's such a good guy. So anyway, that was tragic. He was like in his 50s. They were losing a lot of volunteers and to death. Around the same time that he died, just before that, Joe Pace died. So there's that. But there's been no real problems with the daily meal, weekend meal. We're there from about 11, setting up to breaking down around 3:30 every Saturday and Sunday at the town clock.
And you're getting more mobile, I take it.
Doing any real overt vicious stuff towards us, so that's good.
Anything else you want to report before I take off?
Let's see. What else is going on? There's like a campaign. You know, people might be aware that there's a kind of like the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, Atlantic Council, all these organizations like that, or Harvard University and so on, are all testing central bank digital currencies, and they say they're getting closer and closer rolling it out, and so there's a local campaign to call Cash is Freedom to encourage the an ordinance, mainly for educational purpose, but part to the guarantee that cash can be used in local businesses instead of a digital currency as a way of educating people about it and pushing back on this new biometric ID digital currency program that's being introduced in many parts of the world. Right now, Ukraine is the first totally, fully digital society at this point. So, they've got the DIA, they've got e-government, they call it, and, and the biometric ID that's connected to your passport, your health status, all these things like that. So that country is like the first one. So we're doing we're marching in the different, Brave and Free is marching in Fourth of July parades in both Scotts Valley and Aptos, mainly with that message that, we're trying to push back on this kind of digital prison system that's being proposed, and hopefully it will never happen, and hopefully people will, it'll be clear to people in charge of these ideas that it's not something acceptable to most people. So anyway, there's that.
Okay.
And what else is going on? Houston Food Out Bombs, I think, is up to 39 tickets now out of roughly $1,000, I think it's a ticket, for serving food in front of libraries, Texas. We're still fighting the ordinance in West Palm Beach, Florida, against serving food to homeless people there. People are still all over the world doing food on bonds, and there's lots of new little tiny cities doing food on bonds that are never even. It's like a little Sharksburg outside of Atlanta is going to food on bonds or something like that. It's amazing. Hayward started getting food on bonds started. So that's still all sliding along.
Any word from Commander X?
No, we've lost total contact with Commander X. It's still a mystery, that's for sure. Here's the video about him, the face of Anonymous, is now for free on YouTube. Well, the filmmakers of that, was really interesting to watch, like the little dog, Xavier, and all that, before you got the other little dog. And, this is the anniversary of him moving in with us 12 months ago in June. He marched in the Brave and Free contingent last year. That was his first thing he did when he got out of jail, out of Santa Rita. He lived with us until mid-January, and it was just very hard with the two little dogs, and it turned out, unfortunately, one of the dogs that, Kathleen was super allergic to. So it became really uncomfortable. So he tried to set him up with other housing. And then we thought he did have other housing. And then we lost touch with him. And that was that. And the people that he was allegedly going to be living with, they have no idea what happened to him. So anyway, there's that.
Wow.
So, there's been a pretty big hunt for him, too, because also there's supposed to be some... So the person that organized the movie, the novelist in Toronto, Ian, he called us just the day he emailed me right before... looking for... Right before Commander X was supposed to to be in court for, to avoid getting a warrant for his arrest. And he and Andrew, his probation officer, was came to our house and was really upset that he was hadn't contacted him. He was really worried about him. And it was really interesting building a relationship with a federal probation officer. But he was super into Miranda rights and really trying to help him a ton. It was like really interesting. And he had a really lenient situation too. He went from $500,000 in restitution for the Orlando denial of service and stuff protests he did on my behalf and the Freedom Boss behalf, and with the Peace Camp 2010 action he did here. And it went down to like $20,000 total restitution, something. So he was in a situation where, he was basically home free. And just disappeared. But he also had some kind of new big news that Ian had about, which he never told me, but he wrote me going, oh, you've got to get a hold of Chris, man. And, we got great news about either his book or his movie or something. I don't know. I never found out that part. But we never could find him, so I never found out the news of that. Well, that's where Commander X is.
Well, Keith, I'm going to leave it there, but if you want, give me a call back and give me Baba's phone number. Maybe
I'll give Baba Ito's phone number. So. Cool. And I have to say, Baba Ito's story, sadly, is a representation of what's happening to many people, unfortunately. I hear different versions of this exact story frequently. So, different details and so on, but perfectly healthy people. Cherie might be another example of that, right? She ends up in the mental health system. She was wacky, but she was in the worst danger she was to herself is one time she laughed about how she bed down in what she thought was a empty space because she had bad vision, and it turned out she was sleeping under a car in the driveway. So that is sort of a danger to herself, but to put her on psych med stuff and then basically kill her seemed rude. So, this is like a systemic problem, sadly.
Anything coming up in the next week or the next few weeks you want to mention?
No, I'm not doing anything that makes any sense. I mean, I'm just trying to get my book published, basically. That's all largely what I'm trying to do.
And you will be sending me a complimentary copy, of course.
Oh, I certainly will, because you're all through it. I describe you in great detail. Yep. Mm. That's a drag about writing a memoir where there's so many people you don't write about who were actually really important in your life. And you feel bad that they're not going to be in the book. It would be a 5,000-page book. It had to be like another three more books.
The collected work.
You're in this book because of that's the way it is. So.
Well, Keith,
there you are.
All right. Well, I'm gonna escape while I can.
Okay.
And I will talk to you again when you choose to answer the phone.
Yeah. Okay. Bye-bye.
So I don't think I played this one before. This is another one by David Rovics, but I might have. So I'm going to take a chance on it anyway. It's called Sugihara, and David writes about it. In July 1940, hundreds of Jewish refugees massed at the gates of the Japanese consulate in Kaunas, Lithuania. They were largely Polish Jews fleeing the Nazi terror that had enveloped their country. Heading west through Germany wasn't an option. They had to flee to the east, which meant going through the Soviet Union. Soviet Union and Germany at that time had a non-aggression pact. It was a year before the Germans invaded the Soviet Union. But the only way to get a pass to travel across Siberia was if you had a visa to another country. As implausible as if it was that they might get any help from the Nazis' ally in East Asia, the Japanese Empire, this was their only hope. They would not be disappointed by the Japanese diplomat, Sugihara. that they would shortly encounter.
Was raised in Gifu, on the islands of Japan. He was sent off to Manchuria, that's how this tale began. For his next assignment in the diplomatic corps was far off Lithuania and the European war. My grandfather was from Krakow. The Nazis came, he fled. Took his family to Vilnius so they might not end up dead. But the panzers were advancing, he knew they had to go. But he had to have a visa, and all the embassies said no. There was only one final possibility, the last consulate left open, the Third Reich's Asian ally. There in Lithuania, there was no time to lose. They came asking for a visa, thousands of Polish Jews. The diplomat called Tokyo, can I grant them this reprieve? Three times he got his answer, tell them all to leave. He looked into their eyes, talked to his family. He and his wife decided, we must set these people free. Although I never met him, when all is said and done, I am Sugihara's son. Disobeying orders that they knew to be wrong, Senpo and Yukiko started writing all day long. A month's worth of visas in every 20-hour day. Senpo and Yukiko could turn no refugee away. Word came from the Empire, it's time to turn it in. You're closing down your consulate and moving to Berlin. They knew they did the right thing, of this they had no doubt. They threw visas through the window as their train pulled out. Although I never met him, when all is said and done, I am Sugihara's son. My grandfather crossed Siberia for five times the normal cost, fearing for the future with every minute lost. He got the ferry to Kobe, then to occupied Shanghai. There he spent the war years, while back home his people died. Sugihara-san did not seek praise from anyone. When he died, the paper said, his neighbors knew not what he'd done. But there are 40,000 people living lives today. Without Senpo Sugihara, I'd not be here now to say. Although I never met him, when all is said and done, I am Sugihara's son.
So next you're going to hear a phone interview with Wes White, which I recorded at the Huff meeting, which we do every Thursday at the Sub Rosa Cafe. Join us. It was titled United Pacific Tracks Eviction, July 5th through 7th. We have services we are providing for you, but you cannot continue to stay here. You cannot continue to sleep here. You cannot continue to camp here. Salinas Mayor Kimberly Craig. We're going to make them uncomfortable. They're either going to go to services or they need to go somewhere else. That's the way it is. Salinas City Manager Steve Kerrigan. And the flyer read, demand an address, running water and electricity. It's time for intentional communities in Salinas with curb appeal and organized space, stewardship for ourselves. Put trash to the street. Stay on public property. Enroll in HMIS and CARS. Those are social programs in Monterey County. Get receipts. Video all city employee interactions to bring lawsuit. Take your address on public property and demand fruition of services. Hashtag housing now. Ain't no power like the power of the people. Like the power of the people won't stop. Hashtag stop the streets. Hashtag where do we go, Salinas. Hashtag homeless, not helpless. Hashtag housing, not handcuffs. Hashtag fight poverty, not the poor. And here's the conversation. So we're playing again.
Okay, a little better now.
Much better. I think it was our problem, not yours. I got your flyer downloaded. UP Tracks Eviction, July 5th through 7th. And Coral just asked us how many people this affects.
It affects about 200 plus people.
And 200 plus people is what it says. And the issue is, have you been in touch with these folks yourself directly in the last week or two?
Yes, I was there yesterday monitoring everything. The city police did more than the Union Pacific Tracks because basically their job was just clearing and, stealing everybody's possessions. The city was the one running black to make sure nobody went into Chinatown. And I did capture the assistant chief. I mean, if the city needs to do something unconstitutional, you get the assistant chief to do it. So he's throwing everybody's garbage away. Their possessions, and throwing them in the dumpster as if they're garbage. The dude just put out a whole set of it next to the fence. He put his bike there, and he put a little stack of possessions. And Manny tossed them all in there. And so a dude comes out like 15 seconds later. And he's like, what happened to my stuff? And I was like, it's in the dumpster right on top. Go get it. So he hops in there real quick, and then here comes the loader. And Manny actually stopped it and let the dude take all the stuff back out. But he probably would have never done that if I hadn't been recording.
Now, were you the only person recording, Wes?
Yeah, well, there's a thing about Independence Day. Everyone gets shit-faced loaded on the night. And so nobody could show up this morning. I don't know, that's what I'm going to guess anyway. Otherwise, nobody gave a shit to begin with. But I did tell a few, cop watchers, and nobody showed.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah, me too.
Is this an annual track eviction? Is it?
It's always periodic because where are they right now? Do they do San Lorenzo eviction all the time? No, only when they're there. The city drove everybody out in April from the block under threat of arrest. If you come back and pitch a tent, we're going to arrest you. So everybody went to the tracks. That was in April 11th. And so now, 3 months later, it is time for, the Dilly Bob, the Rodeo. So it's Salinas' version of the Super Bowl, and we got to get everyone clear all the streets. Don't show everybody that we got a bunch of tents anywhere. And so I feel like the next 3 weeks, the city's going to be hot and heavy on destroying people's property. You're free to go, but your possessions are coming with me.
And no one has ever done a lawsuit around this issue that you remember.
No, we haven't. Robbie does have a pro se lawsuit, seminar he could do, help walk somebody through doing it. But you have to find someone who's going to consistently show up to court.
Hmm.
I haven't been able to find somebody like that yet.
I hear you. Well, you are, of course, working with a group that on occasion calls itself the Union of the Homeless, right?
Sure. National Union of the Homeless, yes.
But, of course, you're the only Union of the Homeless member who meets with himself regularly these days, right?
Oh, yeah. For this homeless union, I'm the only surviving member, active member at this point. There are certainly surviving members, but, you know, it's hard because no matter what, and people's effort and attention only lasts for a season. And, you know, that's you got to be pretty hardcore to keep on coming back to this shit.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
You're a hardcore.
Or persistent, or just bored and like the snacks. I'm not sure which.
There you go, it's the snacks.
we have we have pretty good snacks here. I don't know.
Hey, Wes, it's Nicholas here. You really have to be hardcore when you're dealing with a mayor like that. I just read what she said on your flyer.
Yes.
Boy.
Yeah, right, and the city manager, too. That's actually a statement from a couple years ago.
Yeah.
When the Sheriff's Center first opened and the Sprung Shelter, so they actually had vacancies at that point. But there's no vacancies. There's no, they're just brutal. They don't care. Well, it's MRA. There's money to be made, is what it is.
I just want to put these statements in for the record, for our audio record here. The mayor, a woman apparently, says, that's Kimberly Quake, "You cannot continue to sleep here. You cannot continue to camp here. You just can't continue here." And then we're going to make them, I think this is the city manager, Steve Carrigan, we're going to make them uncomfortable. They're either going to go to services or they need to go somewhere else. That's the way it is. Man, this is like 1950s style sheriff, you know, go to the edge of town and don't come back. This is really hardline, ignorant behavior.
Right, very much a sundown town type atmosphere.
Yeah, sundown.
It's never gone away. I mean, when it comes to it, they silently voted Trump, you know, but nobody wanted to admit it. Now everybody's a flag-waving Trumper. It's latest, an awful lot of them. And hopefully they'll have a community dialogue over here in Iris and Sherwood area. Because there's a Trumpy Trumper lady that likes to fly her flag high. And she totally hates it that there's any issue near her neighborhood and wants a council member to do something about it. So I said, I want to be a part of that meeting. So I'm still waiting for that.
Thank you. Thanks, man. Great.
Yeah. Oh, and today, check this out. Yesterday I was really bummed out and, you know, seriously depressed because after 8 years, what has the National Union of Homeless done, right? But this morning, I'm here with a couple friends, checking them out, you know, and also just want to get their feedback. So I have my camera and everything and vests on, and here comes the property owner. "You guys got to go. You get out of here right now." But then he's also like, "You know, I want you to leave before the tractor comes, so then that way you don't damage any of your things, right?" And guess who's actually puppeting him? The assistant chief, Manny Martinez. So he's in the background pressuring dude that if you don't get rid of these people right now, I'm going to charge you thousands of dollars a day. And so that's what he's running off of, you know? And then they end up, I'm recording all this stuff, so they both backed off. They didn't expect that I would be there. That much is certain. So it ends up that Manny says, well, they can stay until Tuesday or Wednesday when they can go back on the tracks. So we won a weekend.
Very good.
For about two dozen people.
Miserably inadequate, I should say, but yeah.
Yeah, for about two dozen people. And, of course, a lot of other people already lost their possessions. You know, more people, as soon as they go somewhere else, you know, they were getting chased away and all their belongings took. You know, I had to leave them all there. Oh, my God, dude. I don't understand this culture. I really don't, and I don't want to understand it.
Do you intend to be continuing to do this visual documentation tomorrow, the next day, and so forth?
I don't know. I mean, seriously, I had doubts about even coming out today because, I was so demoralized. But today, I feel like I just saved people's camp for a weekend till Tuesday or Wednesday, you know, provided that they don't come back. You know, I would imagine the next shift will have a different reason as to why people should leave.
Yeah, could well be. Could well be. We're talking with Wes White, who's in Salinas. He's dealing with this situation here, which is people are being kind of removed from the...
Salinas is bad.
They've been removed from the Union Pacific tracks, and they just moved over to an adjacent private property that was vacant. So then they mobbed it, and, you know, the city didn't want to deal with it because they were too busy running block against everyone else. But now today they have time to tackle the established encampment on this private property. So, you know, they call the owner, so then that way the owner could tell them, and then they don't look like the bad guy.
So how many people specifically are in this particular encampment? You mentioned 200, but...
Right, I'd say about 25 or so, two dozen.
And then what are they going after, 25 by 25? What are they doing?
I think there's about 25 people in tents. I honestly didn't take pictures of the encampment. And there's a few people in cars that are also in the parking spots.
Okay. But by 200, you mean what, in a three or four block?
200 along the tracks. Probably at least 115 have already been cleared in between Chinatown and Alice House Street before John. That's about 115 people was the last head count I got, just about two or three days before the eviction.
And will you be posting any of this video on your YouTube channel?
Eventually, not as hot press though.
Okay.
I'm still a month behind on the Gilroy Fresno stuff, which
happened.
So for
people who are interested in his work,
in May, beginning of June.
For people interested in Wes's work, it's you go to YouTube and then you go to John Doe 13K. Those are two words, JohnDoe 13K, and you can catch Wes White's videos. Anybody any questions for Wes?
Was some of this action taking place on Independence Day itself?
Didn't even happen on the 4th?
No, it happened on the 5th.
Okay.
Happened on the 5th to the 7th is what this flyer says anyway.
Yeah, so yesterday, today, and tomorrow... And possibly next week still.
Right. Anything you want, you would like to know from us, or any questions you have for us, Wes?
Are there any established encampments? Are you folks supporting any places right now?
If by supporting you mean offering cookies once a week at this table, yes.
Okay. They have to come to you, though.
With tea and coffee, whether there's coffee if you want some.
The Poganip's still getting pushed around, I guess. I'm asking.
I'm sorry, say that one more time.
Like the Poganip or wherever people are, they're just constantly getting routed out so you don't have like a established camp to go visit?
I think there are established camps up on our tracks. I don't know if they're Union Pacific or whatever the heck they are. And I haven't heard of massive sweeps going on at the moment up there. And I guess there are some folks living by the tannery that you've mentioned, Coral.
And
in Poganip. And there were police vehicles parked in the Sycamore Grove area. Number of vehicles, I would say four or five. One of them a police, one of them a white community service, a couple of tow truck trailers. I don't know what they were doing. Maybe they're doing some kind of other work, but this is where they were clearing people away about two or three weeks ago. So, yeah, the answer is no, we're not keeping good track at all, except anecdotal track of what's going on here in Santa Cruz. You're doing a far more, you're in a more urbanized area, perhaps, but whatever. You know. So that's my response. Yeah.
Okay. That's fine. I mean, you know, you can't be everywhere at once. I know that much. And it's hard to support anybody. I mean, you know, nobody's really respecting Martin versus Boise. I went to Gilroy and I went to Fresno, and both those were brought up profusely by attorneys. And, you know, the city just went ahead and rubber stamped their stuff anyway.
This was in Fresno and Boise? No.
And Gilroy.
Thank you. Fresno and Gilroy. Okay. And I probably should talk to you about it more at greater length, unless folks have more questions about this for now.
Well, I'll be posting the video soon so you can watch it.
You're doing a good job of describing it verbally, too. I think I'll leave it at that and maybe get back to you as possible later today, but less likely I'm going to run out of steam pretty soon here. And at about that point, I was pretty low on steam, if not running out. And I think that's going to pretty much conclude, other than a little musical ending, or coda, or whatever you will, this particular edition of Bathrop Spears Broadsides will spare you the flashback. But no doubt there'll be lots of them, if not an entirely flashback-ridden show on Sunday. I'm really having lots of physical problems, so I'm not really getting it together with the energy to do this kind of work with the regularity and the frequency that I used to. But who knows? We'll see. We'll see what I can muster, and in the meantime, we'll muster what we can. So let's sign off with this last Rovix number called "A Coup That Wasn't a Coup," about which he writes, "The Egyptian uprising of 2011, Arab Spring, led to the overthrow of the U.S.-backed military government, and ultimately to elections in which the long-held opposition group, the Muslim Brotherhood, won power. The Brotherhood's rule would not last long, however. In July 2013, only a year after Mohamed Morsi's election to the presidency, the Egyptian military seized power and reinstated martial rule. In the process, soldiers slaughtered protesters on a massive scale and jailed and tortured many more. Well aware that this was going on, the Obama administration declared that this military coup wasn't really a military coup. Why deny the obvious reality of what had just happened? Because if a coup had taken place, the U.S. would be legally required to stop selling weapons to Egypt.
There was a revolution in Egypt. The Egyptian people spoke. After decades of dictatorship, they threw off the dictator's yoke. The police killed 1,000 people by the time all was said and done. But the military wouldn't join in the slaughter, and the people won. Eventually, elections were held. The Muslim Brothers got the vote. Right away, the shadow government tried to sink the Brothers' boat. Police were taken off the street. The fuel shortage was engineered. And when the military took the power back, some Egyptians cheered. The Western powers don't like the Brothers. They wanted stability back. And stability means the West is king and Egypt is the jack. So the Western powers hemmed and hawed, looked in the other direction. They said it's kinda like democracy, just without an election. It's an interim government that's a military junta, a coup that wasn't a coup. A massacre that wasn't a massacre. What in the world is the world gonna do? But the Muslim Brothers wouldn't give up. Their leader was detained. So they camped out in the streets of Egypt. Peaceful protest reigned. So with the snipers on the rooftops, bulldozers in the streets, the junta killed the people, and history repeats. Kerry got on TV, said, "Isn't this a shame? Violence is regrettable. Both sides are to blame." The president was playing golf, working on his swing. "Here, have another $1 billion and a meeting in the West Wing." It's an interim government that's a military junta, a coup that wasn't a coup. A massacre that wasn't a massacre. What in the world is the world gonna do? El Baradei resigned. he couldn't take the heat. Just one too many bodies covered over with sheets. You play by the rules and then they change. What's gonna happen next? No one can predict it, but surely this will be the context. It's an interim government that's a military junta. A coup that wasn't a coup. A massacre that wasn't a massacre. What in the world is the world gonna do? It's an interim government that's a military junta. A coup that wasn't a coup. A massacre that wasn't a massacre. What in the world is the world gonna do? What in the world is the world gonna do?
And many more of these fine historical musical accounts can be found on David Rovick's website, davidrovics.com/history. It's he's got one for, I don't know if it's every day of the month, but lots of the days of the month. And there are so many of them, as I said. I apologize if you've heard them before, but if you have, you probably may not remember what they tell us about, which is real history, or at least aspects of it that we need to know and confront. So that's it for this edition of Bathrob Spears Broadsides. If you have any questions or comments, as usual, give a call to the Huff Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom line, and that's also my home phone, 831-423-4833, or, for short, 423-HUFF, 423-HUFF. Likely back at you Sunday. Talk to you either then or sooner.